event coming to Portland. Plus, animation director David Silverman recounts his career as one of the original Simpsons animators. That's all coming up this morning on KBOO. Coming up, we've got Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell right after this.
KBOO at the Clinton in our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. We'll screen two films directed by Les Blank this month. Chulas Fronteras and Del Mero Corazon on Thursday, June 8th at 7 p.m. Del Mero Corazon is a documentary on Chicano culture in America as it is expressed through music, focusing primarily on the Norteño sounds, featuring performances and interviews from Lil Joe and La Familia, Leo Garza, and more. Chulas Fronteras is a documentary about the music of the Mexican community on both sides of the Texas-Mexico border, particularly of migrant farmers. It includes materials about the roots of the music, but devotes principal attention to the music as a protest against oppression and racism. Again, these films will screen Thursday, June 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, a big thing this morning is the James Comey testimony, and I hope to have an excerpt of that in just a few moments. In the meantime, I have some headlines. Professor Jeffrey Sachs, director of the United Nations Sustainable Development Solutions Network, said claims that the Republican billionaire, the president, actually believes climate change is real, made things worse, not better, as this would mean he is knowingly jeopardizing the planet. Just a day after he announced the U.S. withdrawal, Mr. Trump declared a major flooding disaster in Missouri, which climate researcher Dr. John Abraham suggested added to the mounting ironies. And the stream of scientific studies showing evidence of a changing climate has continued. One revealed the number of large wildfires affecting the Great Plains area has increased from an annual average of 33 to 117 in two decades. Another found once rare coastal flooding would become the norm in parts of the U.S. if emissions are not cut, and a third reported the chance of dying in a heat wave in India increased by 146% between 1960 and 2009. In a forthright article on the Project Syndicate website, Professor Sachs suggested the next major storms linked to global warming should be named Typhoon Donald, Superstorm Ivanka, and Mega Flood Jared after the president, his daughter, and son-in-law. When Mr. Trump announced the U.S. would withdraw from the Paris Agreement on climate change, he claimed the rest of the world had been laughing at us because it was such a bad deal for America. Professor Sachs of Columbia University said his speech had displayed a bully's bravado. Quoting Sachs, these ravings are utterly delusional, deeply cynical, or profoundly ignorant, probably all three, and they should be recognized as such. The independent.co UK is where you can find this text. They continue, the decision to withdraw from Paris had not just been Mr. Trump's alone, but reflected the will of the Republican leadership in Congress, including the 22 Republican senators who sent Trump a letter the week before, calling on him to withdraw from the Paris Accord. And the oil and gas industry had spent $100 million on campaign contributions in 2016, of which 90% went to Republican candidates. Now, speaking for myself, it was interesting to see how the oil and gas industry handled the withdrawal. They publicly said that it would be a good thing. Exxon, for example, publicly said that it would be a good thing to keep signed on to the agreements while they had their lackeys in Congress, who were very well paid, urged the president to withdraw. And I'm going to experiment a bit here. It turns out at the last minute I don't have exactly the right connector, but I'm going to try to get you some audio from moments ago, the hearing as former FBI Director Comey speaks to senators about his discussions with President Donald Trump about whether he's being investigated and about whether the president, well, you'll see how this comes out, the tone of whether the president can apply pressure to avoid investigation. Certainly that's the way it comes out. And we'll just see. This is, I think you will first hear a senator.
Touch, obviously it would touch the campaign, and the person at the head of the campaign would be the candidate. And so that was his view throughout.
Let me move to the January 27th dinner.
Okay, this is a senator.
Where you said, quote, the president began by asking me whether I wanted to stay on as FBI director. He also indicated that lots of people, again, your words, wanted the job. You go on to say that the dinner itself was seemingly an effort to, quote, have you ask him for your job and create some sort of, quote, unquote, patronage relationship. The president seems, from my reading of your memo, to be holding your job or your possibility of continuing in your job over your head in a fairly direct way. What was your impression, and what did you mean by this notion of a patronage relationship?
Well, my impression, and again, it's my impression, I could always be wrong, but my common sense told me that what was going on is either he had concluded or someone had told him that you've already asked Comey to stay, and you didn't get anything for it, and that the dinner was an effort to build a relationship, in fact, he asked specifically, of loyalty in the context of asking me to stay. And as I said, what was odd about that is we'd already talked twice about it by that point, and he'd said, I very much hope you'll stay. I hope you'll stay. In fact, I just remembered sitting here a third one. When you've seen the picture of me walking across the blue room, what the president whispered in my ear was, I really look forward to working with you. So after those encounters—
And that was just a few days before you were fired.
Yeah, that was on the Sunday after the inauguration. The next Friday, I have dinner, and the president begins by wanting to talk about my job. And so I'm sitting there thinking, wait a minute, three times you've already asked me to stay or talked about me staying. My common sense, again, I could be wrong, but my common sense told me what's going on here is he's looking to get something in exchange for granting my request to stay in the job.
And again, we all understand, I was a governor, I had people work for me, but this constant request, and again, quoting you, him saying that he, despite you explaining your independence, he kept coming back to, I need loyalty, I expect loyalty. Had you ever had any of those kind of requests before from anyone else you'd worked for in the government?
No. And what made me uneasy was, I'm, at that point, the director of the FBI. The reason that Congress created a 10-year term is so that the director is not feeling as if they're serving at with political loyalty owed to any particular person. The Statue of Justice has a blindfold on because you're not supposed to be peeking out to see whether your patron is pleased or not with what you're doing. It should be about the facts and the law. That's why I became FBI director, to be in that kind of position. So that's why I was so uneasy.
Well, let me move on. My time's running out. February 14th, again, it seems a bit strange. You were in a meeting, and your direct superior, the Attorney General, was in that meeting as well, yet the president asked everyone to leave, including the Attorney General to leave, before he brought up the matter of General Flynn.
Jeff Sessions, he's asking to leave.
That type of action. And have you ever seen anything like that before?
No. My impression was something big is about to happen. I need to remember every single word that is spoken. And again, I could be wrong. I'm 56 years old. I've been seen a few things. My sense was the Attorney General knew he shouldn't be leaving, which is why he was lingering. And I don't know Mr. Kushner well, but I think he picked up on the same thing. And so I knew something was about to happen that I needed to pay very close attention to.
And I found it very interesting that in the memo that you wrote after this February 14th pullicide, you made clear that you wrote that memo in a way that was unclassified. If you affirmatively made the decision to write a memo that was unclassified, was that because you felt at some point the facts of that meeting would have to come clean and come clear and actually be able to be cleared in a way that could be shared with the American people?
Well, I remember thinking this is a very disturbing development, really important to our work. I need to document it and preserve it in a way, and this committee gets this, but sometimes when things are classified, it tangles them up. It's hard
Amen.
To share it within an investigative team. You have to be very careful about how you handle it for good reason. So my thinking was, if I write it in such a way that I don't include anything that would trigger a classification, that'll make it easier for us to discuss within the FBI and the government and to hold on to it in a way that makes it accessible to us.
Well, and again, it's our hope, particularly since you're a pretty knowledgeable guy and you wrote this in a way that was unclassified, that this committee will get access to that unclassified document. I think it would be very important to our investigation. Let me just ask this in closing. How many ongoing investigations at any time does the FBI have
going on? Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. Did the president ever ask about any other ongoing investigation?
No.
Did he ever ask about you trying to interfere on any other investigation?
No.
I think, again, this speaks volumes. This doesn't even get to the questions around the phone calls about lifting the cloud. I know other members will get to that, but I really appreciate your testimony and appreciate your service to our nation.
Thank you, Senator Warren.
Okay, and so you were listening to senators interviewing the former FBI director, James Comey, and you heard him respond that Trump basically, well, I don't want to put words in his mouth, so let me just characterize what was described as President Trump trying to act as a don, as a capo, trying to give the message, as Comey said, under the aspect of patronage, to impress upon Comey that despite his 10-year tenure, despite the fact that the FBI director had intentionally been separated from the direct influence of the presidency, Trump really wanted to get his loyalty and to be sure that he was going to do as Trump wanted, as Trump directed. Very interesting indeed, and these hearings are still going on. You can find them in various places. YouTube is one place to find it, find live coverage. So you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. There's a number of things I want to talk about, principally. I want to talk about this situation with James Comey and the president, and then I want to move to some news headlines, more news headlines, and then I want to talk about the behavior of the Portland police under the context of this sort of demagoguery and this thuggish behavior on behalf of the president, the sort of atmosphere that we are now under, and the danger that we now face of rolling fascistization. First, continuing with the situation with James Comey, now testifying before the Senate. This is from The Guardian in Britain. Legal experts agree that James Comey's account of his 9 conversations with Donald Trump earlier this year presents strong evidence of obstruction of justice and attempt to bury an investigation into the Trump campaign's contacts with Moscow. Testimony could establish whether Trump's conversations with the ex-FBI chief were simply high-level confidential chatter or something crossing into illegality. And speaking for myself, You may also find it interesting to hear what Oregon Senator Ron Wyden asks Comey, and that was just a few minutes ago as well. Once again, you can find it in various places on the web. Just use a web search engine and you will find the ongoing live hearings. Returning to the Guardian article, however, there were mixed opinions on whether it would be enough for a conviction or impeachment. Articles of impeachment would have to be passed by the House of Representatives, and most Republicans on Wednesday evening appeared to close ranks in support of Trump, despite the details of Comey's statement. And I would add to that, by far, most Republicans, and that is what is going to keep an impeachment from coming down anytime soon. But returning to the article, Comey's statement to the Senate Intelligence Committee was released on Wednesday ahead of his eagerly awaited appearance before the Senate Intelligence Committee on Capitol Hill today. Some observers said the statement would add momentum to multiple investigations into the conduct of the Trump campaign, which could in turn produce yet more damaging testimony that would be hard for Republicans to ignore. Comey's evidence also contradicted Trump's account of the conversations in which he denied demanding loyalty of Comey. If the president repeated his version under oath, he could face accusations of perjury. Quoting Harvard University professor of constitutional law, Lawrence Tribe, quote, Comey's entirely credible prepared statement strengthens my belief that the president sought to influence and even end an ongoing investigation into serious wrongdoing by Michael Flynn and others close to the president that constitutes obstruction of justice, end quote. And of course, that's the big phrase, speaking for myself, obstruction of justice. Will the president be allowed to get away with it? Returning to the article, Richard Painter, who was ethics counsel in the George W. Bush administration, argued that a determination on whether Trump was guilty of obstruction of justice would require more evidence. Now, quoting Painter, the key question is whether there was a threat to fire Comey if he did not do what he was told. I was thinking asking for loyalty as a condition of employment, the times he asked him to drop the Flynn investigation, and the fact that he was actually fired, putting those three occurrences together is strong evidence that Trump was communicating to Comey that he would fire him if he didn't drop the investigation, end quote. And also quoting Painter, there's a question of whether it would be enough to convince a jury. A lot would depend on if there were other witnesses who say, here Trump said, I'm going to fire him if he doesn't drop the case, or if he was on tape saying, I will fire you if you don't. That would be clear-cut evidence, but there's certainly enough for the House and Senate Judiciary Committees to start holding hearings and calling witnesses, end quote. Comey is likely to be asked questions about the context for the conversations with Trump when the former FBI director gives oral testimony on Thursday morning, and as I mentioned, this is going on right now. So, the number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, KBOO Radio. You're listening to Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell. And as I was saying, I'd like to get to some more headlines. And I want to talk about the actions of Portland's Police Department and of the Federal Police at Sunday's Little In Nazi demonstration. Jason Deitz writes in antiwar.com, with all diplomatic ties between Qatar and most of its fellow GCC, that's Gulf Council members, now severed in an ideological row with Saudi Arabia, the Saudi kingdom has publicly issued an ultimatum, giving Qatar just 24 hours to give in to a litany of major demands, with speculation they would face immediate military invasion if they don't submit by then. Now, speaking for myself, I don't think Deitz is correct in that quite exactly, because of the it's a tiny country with a giant U.S. military base, so I can't see an invasion going on, and if it did, then that would be big news indeed. But returning to the rest of what Deitz says, the 10 demands get progressively more outrageous, starting with demands for Qatar to publicly sever all ties to Iran and officially apologize for how mad the Saudis got at them. It gets more and more extreme from there, demanding Qatar expel every member of Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood from the nation and freeze all their bank accounts. Ultimately, the demands also include Qatar publicly vowing never to have any policy again, which is perceived as contradicting the GCC's official stance. The GCC is dominated heavily by Saudi Arabia. So this, in effect, means Qatar must promise to eternally and irrevocably endorse the Saudi position, past, present, and future, on all things. Speaking for myself, basically the Saudis are telling Qatar, you will now cease to be a sovereign nation. You will bow literally to us. This is what happens when the U.S. Supports kings. They act like kings. The UAE, in solidarity with Saudi Arabia, He is also threatening up to 15 years in jail and a fine of more than $130,000 for anyone who expresses sympathy for Qatar on social media. That's according to the Associated Press. Another one of the demands from the Saudis is that they want Al Jazeera, the semi-independent Qataris media source, shut down entirely. No more Al Jazeera, or they'll something. They've already successfully cut off, well, groceries since they control water routes into Qatar. There have been runs in grocery stores. Qataris are trying to arrange supplies in some other manner. So they're facing quite a decision. Either they lose their sovereignty, such as it is under a king. I can't say that I'm terribly sympathetic about that. Or they literally kowtow to the Saudis from now on. Now turning to the situation with North Korea. Missiles have been shot off the coast. These are anti-ship missiles. South Korean military spokesman Ro Jae-chan said the launch of missiles was in response to joint drills and intended to show off Pyongyang's widening range of missiles and its precision strike capabilities on ships. This is from CNN. To be specific, speaking for myself, these missiles are the types that one would use to sink aircraft carriers. And of course, the U.S. Had aircraft carriers off the coast. You may recently have seen pictures of North Korean missiles being shot that have fins on the upper stage. That's a slightly different missile, but these would be similar in that they are intended to operate within the atmosphere rather than being ballistic missiles that go above the atmosphere and then drop down. North Korea's weapons tests, CNN writes, I think it's CNN, are meant to build a nuclear missile program that can stand up to what it sees as U.S. and South Korean hostility. But they are also considered by outside analysts as a way to make its political demands clear to leaders in Washington and Seoul. Skipping ahead, the launch is Thursday with North Korea's fourth missile test since the new President Moon inauguration in South Korea on May 10th. And they quote an analyst, Kim Dong-yub, at Seoul's Institute for Far Eastern Studies, saying the projectiles, which showed longer range than North Korea's previously known KN-1 and anti-ship cruise missiles, were likely from a new cruise missile system the North displayed during a massive April 15th military parade. The improved range indicates that North Korea is pursuing weapons capable of reaching U.S. aircraft carriers that operate from deeper positions. And I suppose deeper positions, he means further offshore. Now, speaking for myself, the other aspect of this is that the U.S. has the capability to shoot down missiles to a certain degree from its various ships. One of the systems is called Phalanx, or was basically a computer-operated, radar-guided, high-speed cannon shoots clouds of uranium bullets toward an incoming missile. And it is capable of shooting one or two missiles at a time. The way North Korea could defeat that would be to shoot several missiles and or to have missiles that act like the new Exocet anti-ship missiles do, which is to say they are capable of diving down close to the surface and zipping around side to side so that it's hard to shoot at them. We live in an era in which anti-ship missiles are vastly more capable than the countermeasures when they are used in earnest and in mass. So I would say that if they have that capacity, and of course the Pentagon knows what capacity those missiles have, then that might be an effective deterrent for them. Hard to say. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. From Caracas, right-wing opposition protests in Venezuela are attacking journalists, with accounts of reporters having shots fired at them as well as gasoline thrown at them in an attempt by protesters to set them on fire. That's from Radio Havana, Cuba. Speaking for myself, journalists here in Portland are under stress from police, and so it was interesting to see how it comes down in Caracas. But they write the latest case was Telesur correspondent Adriana Savori, who was shot in the back while reporting from an anti-government protest in the western Caracas parish of El Paraiso early Monday morning. In an interview with Telesur, Savory recalled how several press people were stuck on a bridge when opposition protesters attacked them. Quoting Savory, "We were all reporting, as we usually do, when Molotov cocktails, nails, and bullets came raining down on us from a nearby building. The Molotovs came from a gate by the building, while the shots came from the building but above us." Visibly shaken, they write, Savory urged an end to the violence. Quoting, "I've been at risk before, but this is different. We need dialogue with everyone, like everyone wants, like some of the opposition wants." Adding, "All press, regardless of tendency, has to be respected. Opposition violence against national and international journalists has been repeatedly denounced by the Bolivarian government and various members of the communications options." So, number to call with your comments about James Comey's testimony about the Trump administration, about creeping fascistization, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now, from various social media reports, I was not at the Sunday demonstrations. I did drop off a couple of friends, but I was feeling very tired. I had just been to the coast and realized that I would not be able to walk around very much without needing other people's help after a while. Kind of old and shaky after my various operations, so I decided not to attend. And I'm sorry in a sense, because apparently, although the demonstration went on peacefully, the Portland police decided to take some revenge on the anti-fascist protesters after the fact. I have some information from Dan Handelman from Copwatch. Dan, if you're listening, if you want to call in, that would be fine with me. Aside from that, on the video record, we have evidence of the Portland Police Department searching and photographing the papers of journalists as an act of intimidation, apparently. Of the PPD deploying riot control agents against a passive and peaceful crowd. And I might ask, the official excuse was that bricks were gathered, but where is a photo of a brick being thrown? And where is, for that matter, where is the no doubt dramatic video evidence of a flaming Molotov cocktail being deployed at the May Day protest? That was the excuse back then. I think these are brazen lies. And then there is evidence, video evidence. Now on the web, here again, you can turn to YouTube, where you can find the Portland police allowing a right-wing demonstrator to participate in arresting leftists. Particularly, there is a video of a man who, as far as I can tell, hasn't caused any violent harm, went over to the fascist side of the demonstration, stood around, probably said some annoying things, and then when he tried to run, was tackled and hogtied. And one of the right-wing group was allowed to participate, even to the point of pulling a zip tie off the back of a cop. That's how cozy and familiar he was with the cop, to tie the man's hands. Quoting the Mercury, Doug Brown's article, on Sunday, a right-wing militia member helped federal officers chase, pin down, and handcuff a protester who tried to enter the pro-Trump rally at Terry Shrunk Plaza. The feds are now investigating. The incident involved the private citizen is under review with the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's a quote from DHS spokesman Lucy Martinez telling the Mercury. Continuing with the Mercury article, the man working security for the rally has seen on multiple videos assisting DHS police officers from the Federal Protective Service. So I had that wrong. My apology. Wasn't assisting Portland police, was assisting Federal Protective Service, arresting the guy. At one point, they write, he unfurls a zip tie handcuff from the federal agent's belt before handing it to the agent, who then puts it on the wrist of the guy who's pinned down, end quote. And that's, speaking for myself, that's just with white people in broad daylight. And I would say the election of President Trump has brought out the latent fascism of cops all over the country. And it was a very interesting scene, what with the federal and local police all massing together. Number call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. I have some more details on this, but the reason I'm bringing this up and making a big deal about it on my show is we still have a tiny bit of a window to speak up about this and to slap it down, because this sort of thing has been creeping since the election of Trump. It was predicted by people who follow fascism that police forces would feel emboldened in acting out in this way once Trump was elected. And I'm encouraging you to call in. I say comments and questions, but I'm actually hoping that you will call in to denounce this sort of police activity. I'll give you some more details in a moment, but fact is, the cops were not even-handed at the demonstrations Sunday. And some of the things that they did were quite disturbing indeed, such as the, you know, show me your papers incidents, the kettling, their assist by right-wingers, etc. And Sam is on the air. The number to call, 503-231-8187. Hello, Sam.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
So, I'm an old guy with a poor memory, but I wondered if you had any information about the effort in the 60s by the city of Fort Collins, Colorado, taking the weapons off their policemen, putting them in nice-looking blazers, and putting police services on the sides of the cars so that a countervailing mindset from this militarization of these robocops, which I believe trigger and foment this this violent confrontation.
No, I don't have any information about that at all. Can you give me a bit more information? Maybe it can be looked up. You say it was Sacramento?
No, Fort Collins, Colorado.
Colorado. Okay, and that was in the 60s?
Yeah, I believe it was.
Okay, well, I guess we can turn to our friends, the web search, and see what we can find out about that.
It was all the buzz that this was a new day in policing and we were going to de-escalate the confrontation, which is just the exact opposite of what's going on now. That's all I wanted to ask, and I'll get off the air. Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks. It's an interesting point. Thank you. It's been done before, and these are the questions I want to ask. What should be done about the police? Should the, after all has been said and done about American police, the problems that we have with police. And I'll say this so people won't bother calling in. Of course, there's good cops. Of course, they do good things. Of course, if your kid's missing, they'll help you. There are heroes there. But we need to talk about this ugly side of Portland police departments, which, not Portland, but American police departments, in which there is an ongoing and self-replicating fraternity whose characteristics are virulently racist, fascist, authoritarian, who move without consequence, without oversight, who have subverted the grand jury process so that they can kill pretty much who they want. And so we have a separation in terms of who gets what kind of justice, if you want to call it justice. A high-valued person, an affluent, educated, and white person, unlikely to be gunned down by the cops, and if they are, there's likely to be consequences. Anyone who does not have the whiteness, we can talk about whiteness if you want, anyone who does not have the education, who does not have the money, the cash, can effectively be rubbed out. This is what we face right now. This is why you feel more than a little nervous and you see those red lights flashing behind your car. Sure, it's probably a traffic stop, but if you're a person of color, if you're a transgender, if you're a dissenter like me, you really don't know how it's going to come out. And within my own experience, I have been threatened with 10 years in prison for, here's the laugh line, beating up a couple of cops. Oh, yeah. Poor things. Long story, but this is getting more and more dangerous. And I urge you, take a stand, confront this, not just in the streets. You need to confront this on your People's Community radio station. I need to hear your voice calling in 503-231-8187, and I need to know what kind of actions should be taken given the actions of the police, given the fact that their attitude results in actions that range from obnoxious to murderous. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Nancy's on the air. Hi, Nancy, you're on.
Hi, this is Nancy Newell. I worked on Enron with Robert McCullough years ago, and also the closure of Trojan, and I've been an activist for many years. And what citizens don't realize here in Portland, we've got our own form of Trump, because our mayor privatized our bowl run drinking water system by giving the debt to the banks when we've already paid into the infrastructure costs, and all it has to be is drawn out, like Food and Water Watch pointed out. Several municipalities across the country have already done that, and he refuses to do so. And he acts to somehow the protesters are more dangerous than anybody in his police commissioner role. When he's mayor, he is also police commissioner, and he doesn't seem to understand the role as upholding the Constitution for the people that were demonstrating Sunday. And the actions of the police, children got hit with tear can canisters in the face, directly in the face.
Are you talking about Sunday?
Way beyond, and this is not Trump. This is our mayor, our police commissioner. He's not being held responsible. The public doesn't realize, and more has to be talked about.
This tear gas accusation, are you talking about Sunday?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, go ahead.
Democrats think that, you know, criticizing Trump is enough. We've got it at our own level. That's his main thing. Trump is privatizing water all over the U.S., and that's what our mayor has done here. And he tells me every time I talk about it down at City Council that it's not true. Well, look into it, everybody, because Food and Water Watch really disagrees. We lost our water to Nestle's from the Governor Brown up at the Cascade Locks. Are we going to lose our Bull Run water? We've lost it. Unless we fight it. So that's what we've got to do nonviolently.
Food and Water Watch, okay. And do you have any other indices, a way to look this up? Foodandwaterwatch.org, perhaps?
Look, Nick Fish's website, he'll have information there that is not accurate, but at least you'll know what's happening.
Okay, you can get some frame that way. All right.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much for that information. Now we'll talk about. Okay. Yeah, I'm talking about fascistization of the police force in the course of the society. Now these right wingers came to town Sunday, knowing that they came in the context of a double murder of a man who screamed his racist hatred. Their mouths overflowing with lies and evasions about whether that had to do with their rally. But of course, it was impossible to have that rally, being who they are, being representatives and coddlers and associates of mass murderers like Nazis and Klansmen, and not have the intimidation effect. And that was what that rally was about. And so Portland won, in a sense, because they went there to intimidate. They went to the Federal Plaza to get federal protection for what they alleged was free speech, and which was actually an act of barely disguised intimidation. They were confronted appropriately by at least 3-1, some people say 4, 5, 6-1 counter demonstration, and that was right. That was well done. Now, I can't say that everything that happened there was well done. I could see videos of people taunting cops using a sort of nursery rhyme cadence, saying all cops are bastards. I don't see what point that makes at all. And I would encourage people to remember that even when you get caught up in the moment in a demonstration, video records are forever. And do you really want to see that coming out of your mouth 10 years from now in that term? I think we can be more adult than that. Taunting the cops is pretty pointless. Happens, though, I understand. I understand that it does happen. But then, well, there's what the cops did do after that. When it comes to kettling people and letting them go only on the condition that they allow their ID to be photographed, that is an act of intimidation. And for those of you who say, oh, no, it's not, we should all be open with our records and journalists have passes and blah, 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 let me explain why it's an act of intimidation for the cops to take your information when you are not specifically accused of doing anything wrong. In the first place, it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. In the second place, the reason violations of your privacy and your anonymity are important is because of prosecutors. Let me explain to you what prosecutors do, and I speak as someone who's experienced this personally. When you are taken into a courtroom and you are accused, for example, let's say that you've been kettled, let's say that you are kettled sometime in the future, which is to say you are prevented from leaving and then charged with, as 230 people in D.C. are now being charged, with crimes that could lead to you spending 70 years in prison. There, even journalists are being charged with this. You then confront a system that is not at all interested in the phrase innocent until proven guilty. That's not what it's about. That is a lie. The U.S. court system does not hold you innocent until you are proven guilty. Let me just, that's just such a basic thing. It needs to be understood. The U.S. court system is not interested in your innocence. Prosecutors are not there to determine what the truth is. This is very important. You must understand. This should be part of your decision whether to protest or not. I would suggest that you set up your resources in advance before you protest now and in the future. Understand, I do this. For example, if I were taken in on false charges again, it's sad, but I would simply have to put my house up for sale to get the resources to fight it. But that's, you know, a decision I've already made in advance. It's like free speech is important, more important than having a house, frankly. You need resources. You either need access to a lawyer who will work for you for nothing, or you need thousands and thousands of dollars. And preferably, you need a network of connections legally to get out of a charge, because you are not innocent until proven guilty. You are guilty until it is proven that you have financial and legal resources to fight back the system, and even then you're rolling the dice. That's how it works. That's how it happens that you have a racist police force bring in people on the basis of racial animus. People will be charged with outrageous things, a litany of outrageous things when they are brought in. People of color, anyone the cops don't like, anyone the cops decide to beat up, will be brought in, charged with a seemingly insuperable litany of charges, and eventually presented with what's called a plea deal, in which you agree to plead guilty to something less, which can still be devastating, which can still mark you as a felon or even a sex offender, all kinds of things they will charge you with. And then just to get your freedom, because you realize that you don't have tens of thousands of dollars or a network of legal support that you can depend on to, as I say, roll the dice against the system, well, you plead and maybe you get out. But I want to emphasize, you will face a prosecutor. A prosecutor will take everything that you ever put on social media, every record that can ever be made of you will be searched through. And all of the things that would point, if you decide to go to a jury, if you have enough funds to go to a jury, which sadly is the best thing you can do, everything you ever said, every court record, everything in your divorce papers, every accusation against you will be lined up. And the prosecutor will then make you out to be a monster. And believe you me, you can be made out to be a monster. Now, it isn't logical. It isn't fair. It isn't justice. It is not an attempt to find justice. I'm not exaggerating. This is how it's done. The prosecutor is operating a game. The prosecutor keeps track of how many cases he or she wins. That's what it's about. They want to win. And that means crushing you. And they try to separate themselves emotionally from what they do, but what they're doing is crushing people, and especially they're crushing people who do not have extensive resources. So it is very serious that we have the PPD kettling, searching, photographing the papers of people and journalists is an act of intimidation, and they probably realized that, and that's why some of them were denying it after the fact, but it did happen. It is on video. It's very serious. It is fascistization. It is the spreading fascism coming from the election of President Trump, and I want to know what you think about it and what you would like to do about it, whether you will talk to the mayor about it. The number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And by the way, if you can get on a jury, please do. And remember this, you have the right to jury nullification. That means if there's anything wrong with the prosecution, if it's just as I described, which it usually is, if it's exaggerated, if the penalties are too much, you have the right to say not guilty. And in this state, which is set up to prevent any one person from doing that in order to allow more racist prosecutions to go through. You have to recruit someone else to say not guilty. And when you are in there, they will tell you, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. But you have the right and the moral duty to do that. Jury nullification. Get on the jury. Do the right thing. And John's on the air. Or is it Tom? Tom's on the air. Sorry, Tom.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
You know, this thing that there are good cops, I think the last good cop was Serpico, and the other cops tried to kill him. So the way you can tell a good cop from a bad cop is you ask the cop. You say, hey, who are the bad cops? The good cops will tell you who the bad cops are, and that's zero. They choose to be bad cops. So they would prefer to protect some guy that who's falsifying evidence and putting innocent people in jail than being a decent human and saving an innocent person from some corrupt cop. So the idea that there's some good cops is like saying there's some good Nazis. You know, they're all part of a horrible system that they're willing to perpetuate.
It's the groupthink that I rail against, and it is that nature of the fraternity and the code of silence which has kept this phenomenon in place, in which we cannot look to justice from police. We can sometimes, occasionally get help, but you're always in danger.
I'm just a normal white dude. I get pulled over all the time for nothing. I've been stop and frisk so many times in this city. I've lived here my whole life. When they used to pull me over and do the stop and frisk, I didn't realize it was a stop and frisk at the time. I just thought, well, maybe I made a weird turn or maybe I did something wrong. You know, I gave the cop the benefit of the doubt that I did something wrong, which I hadn't. It still happens today. The last time I got pulled over, he said I didn't signal for long enough. And it's like, what? I signaled plenty long. Isn't there more important things to worry about in this world?
Do you have a new Mercedes?
No, I've got some old crappy Honda that looks crappy, so I must be a drug addict or something.
I brought that up because of the classism of the police.
God, but anyways, good luck. There's so much that could be said, and thanks for the good work. Anyway, have a nice day.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187. I'm asking, what is your attitude and what will you do? Will you contact the mayor about this misbehavior by the police, about the collaboration with the right-wingers, about the act of intimidation, photographing people's papers, about the use of riot control agents against a passive and peaceful crowd, about the lies about bricks being thrown, the lies about Molotov cocktails being thrown last May. And Rolf is on the air.
Hello.
Rolf is on the air.
You got me?
Yeah. Hi, Rolf. What's up?
Hello. Well, there's a lot to be said, I guess. To backtrack a couple minutes about what you were saying with anti-police chants and stuff, one important thing to remember is demonstrators that keep an eye on the police force locally already have a pretty big issue with a lack of justice within the police ranks in the PPB, and they've seen them shoot several black kids this year, and no one really get punished or fired, and for that reason, and the reason that they continue to escalate every demonstration with their incredibly militarist forces, enough to say that they're all bastards. And, when you blatantly use excessive force habitually and everyone gets away with it and there's no sense of justice at all, can you blame somebody for saying nan nan a boo boo?
And then I can't really blame you in the spirit of the moment. For taking that attitude. I'm just saying tactically, think about what you're doing.
Yeah, and I totally agree. But then at the same time, you know, you've got a crowd of people who aren't armed with firearms, aren't armed with tasers or all the heavily militarized weapon, talking to people that are and just saying literally, nan, nan, boo, boo, you're a jerk. And they get so provoked by this, like children, that they go and shoot explosive chemical weapons at children, elderly, disabled people. I mean, that's is that the people we want protecting us? Is people that are so easily provoked as to launch explosives at vulnerable populaces simply for exercising their First Amendment right to assemble? Saying all cops are bastards is freedom of speech. It has to go both ways.
You know? You're absolutely
they have
right.
To protect
sure.
They have to protect the people saying all cops are bastards, and they claim every time that somebody throws something at them. Now, they claim this time that there's a brick thrown at them, but there's no video of that. There's hundreds of people videoing that whole interaction. No video of that. They say they dislodged bricks from the bathrooms there. People have gone back to that restroom over the past couple of days. All the bricks are still in the building. There's no brick removed. Where did it come from? Why, you know, is there any evidence for their claims at all?
Well, and part of the problem is the
reason,
local media.
The reason that they cleared out Chapman Square is to provide the alt-right with safe passage out. And it was very well timed. It was a half an hour before their rally was supposed to end. They knew people would take issue with them leaving peacefully. And so they cleared out the most, you know, aggressive, quote-unquote, counter-rally part right on time, clear them out, and made excuses to use chemicals and you know, weapons, explosives against them. And then when they took off on their own you know, jaunt of exercising their First Amendment rights, they were corralled. They were unconstitutionally violated. You don't have to provide police with identification in the state of Oregon. You only have to provide them with your name and address. And so they were coerced into giving up information that constitutionally they do not have to. So the police is a clear violation of the Constitution. It's all on video. Then they go and deny it the next day. And then they don't even talk about it at City Hall the next time they have a session. They're talking about something else. They're like, oh, we'll talk about that later. Why do they get to decide, though?
Well, and I'll just get down to what I was hinting, is I think the mayor should come down for this. It's like, if he's a police commissioner and the cops act like this, if they take sides in this sort of thing, much less fail to protect us from basically what is an act of intimidation from well-known death squads, then he should not be the mayor.
Yeah. I totally agree. And I think it's very clear as day that this is not a either bipartisan or a political city government or police department that we're dealing with. They definitely realize that the right wing, especially the extreme right wing, support police brutality, and they're very forward about that, and because of that, the police support them back. And that's not how the system should work, because even the leftists or counter demonstrators, whatever, they still pay their taxes with some, you know, delusional semblance that they're going to be protected, their constitutional rights are going to be protected, and they just fail to see that happen over and over again. And it's pretty obvious who what side the cops are on every time. So,
well, thank you very much for your comments. I want to turn now to comments by Dan Handelman in an email, which was sent out to the Portland Cop Watch list, referring to the ACLU's report back on what happened, included some of the more disconcerting issues: arbitrary use of violence after conflicting commands, the kettling of almost 200 people, including journalists, followed by photographing them and their IDs, and the crackdown caught up people merely observing what was going on. Those familiar with the Portland Cop Watch's long struggle to be sure the Bureau complies with Oregon state law prohibiting collecting or maintaining information on people's social, political, or religious affiliations will appreciate the ACLU's comment on how the mass arrest potentially violates that statute. There's also a story which has been getting a lot of play. One of the people from the free speech rally, decked out in body armor, assisted federal police in arresting a counter demonstrator. The U.S. DOJ says, the Department of Justice says, it is investigating. This there follows references to articles in the Mercury.com. A detailed look, he writes, of the detention of journalists in the Tribune says that two of their folks and people from KATU, ironic, huh, because that's fairly right-wing media, BuzzFeed, Reuters, and Willamette Week were detained. You can find that at portlandtribune.com. He writes, we raised questions about the photographing IDs and targeting of observers in our May Day debrief. And the chief claimed on Think Out Loud that it was against Bureau policy to photograph IDs and that he didn't think the Portland police were doing that. But backtracked later when PIO Sergeant Pete Simpson told him to. Dan also writes, it's also worth noting that the Citizen Review Committee, which has its crowd control work group meeting a couple days ago at 4 p.m., yesterday at 4 p.m., during the warship arrivals, tried to find the Bureau out of policy for ordering the mass detention of activists at a 2014 post-Ferguson demonstration last year. But Chief Marshman convicted them that such tactics were within policy and training, so the police could not be held accountable for it. So I'm asking for your comments and questions. 503-231-8187. Comments from Matt Dos Santos, legal director of the ACLU. On Sunday, thousands of people peacefully assembled in downtown Portland to express themselves just as the First Amendment envisions. He writes, a planned alt-right rally, the timing of which was awful and lacked respect for the city's grief over the murders on the Max the previous week, drew many more counter-protesters than attendees. The tremendous outpouring of support from numerous immigrant right groups, organized labor, faith-based movements, and other anti-racists showed the alt-right demonstrators that while they have the constitutional right to speak, their message of white supremacy is unwelcome by the people of Portland. He writes, this is the power of the First Amendment. When we organize and collectively raise our voices, we can reject the messages of hate and intolerance that permeate our communities. For the first 4 hours of the demonstrations, law enforcement successfully kept groups separated in an effort to avoid conflict. Overall, the strategy of keeping people separated while allowing each group to be heard kept the peace for hours. Things took a dangerous turn as police deployed flashbang grenades, chemical irritants, and less lethal bullets at the anti-fascist gathering. To the cheers of the alt-right group, after the police announced that projectiles and a foul-smelling liquid were thrown from the roof of the public bathroom in Chapman Park. Now, speaking for myself, the only evidence of this is beefy-looking people photographed on top of the bathroom. It's not clear who those people were, whether they did, what was claimed. And I would like to say that this sort of claim takes place in a context, for example, of the context of the by now obviously false claim of attacks from Molotov cocktails, which is a firebomb attack on May 1st, in the context of police provocateur activity versus left-wing groups that goes back, well, as far back as 1896. So I'm very suspicious of that claim. But returning to the ACLU head, Matt Dos Santos, legal director in Portland, ACLU, he writes, while we understand that policing is no easy task, the pattern in Portland is clear. After a rock, stick, or liquid is thrown, Portland protests regularly devolve into the indiscriminate use of force and crowd control weapons. Our democracy is not so fragile, he writes, that a rock thrown turns off the First Amendment for everyone in our city. This kind of disproportionate response is dangerous to our democracy and our lives. To our knowledge, no other police force in America uses crowd control weapons with the regularity of the Portland Police Bureau. It bears repeating that these less lethal weapons are dangerous and indiscriminate. In fact, he writes, our staff attorney who was serving as legal observer in Chapman Square was accosted with chemical irritants and then shot in the back of her leg as she was trying to comply with police orders. A street medic was shot while treating someone for injuries sustained during the police action. Flashbangs went off immediately behind an elderly person using a cane as they desperately tried to exit the park, causing her to stumble. These are just a few of the many examples of innocent people being caught up in Sunday's police violence. It may be tempting to find comfort in the fact that in a very tense scenario, things did not get far worse, but we cannot accept this as normal law enforcement behavior. I'm calling for Mayor Ted Wheeler to resign so we can elect a mayor who, as police commissioner, will rein in these people. And also, I want to comment generally as we get towards the top of the hour here that Portland, over the years, has gotten a reputation for being a riotous city. And I've been here for yay many years. I've been here and participating in demonstrations in Portland off and on since 1990. And I think almost without exception, over and over and over again, I have seen the pattern that the Portland police, with their special armor and their ranks, their batons, their fireworks, their gas, their pepper spray, their intimidation, their ATVs, their beanbag lead weapons, their rubber-coated steel bullets, have goaded and terrorized and chased people into an angry and frightened mob time and again. And this has worked in convincing the nation and the world that the problem is the people of Portland rather than the Portland police. The Portland police are the problem. Mayor Wheeler, you are the problem. I know you haven't had much time, but you've failed spectacularly. You must go. Please turn in your resignation. And let's have a mayoral election that will actually confront the Portland Police Union, and turn to something different. Let's say an entirely different budget for a police force and an elimination from the Portland police from the Portland city budget. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM in Cascadia and other frequencies nearby via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
It's community radio for Portland, KBOO Portland. At 10:15 today, join us for Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, it's Between the Covers with David Naiman. Today, talking to Dani Shapiro about her intensely emotional novel, Hourglass, Time, Memory, Marriage, about the joys and challenges of matrimonial life. And then at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, author and comics chronicler R.C. Harvey stops by to talk about the National Cartoon Society's Reuben Awards event coming to Portland. Plus, animation director David Silverman recounts his career as one of the original Simpsons animators. That's all coming up this morning after Chris Andre hosts Ear Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. That is coming right up here on The Boo. Hey, thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at